This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who isn't worried about violent crime nowadays? Congress has been responding with legislation designed to get tough on criminals. Last year's crime bill included a 3 strikes and you're out provision. The proposed Republican crime bill calls for creating tougher penalties to deter criminals. Meanwhile, the prison population nearly tripled during the 1980s. The chance that an African-American male was in a jail or prison was 7 times that of a white male. What do you make of that? My guest Michael Tonry says African-Americans are being disproportionately targeted by crime policies. Tonry is the author of a new book about race and crime called Malign Neglect. He's also the general editor of the Oxford University Press series Studies in Crime and Public Policy, and he's a law professor at the University of Minnesota. Tonry told me why he's studying race and crime.
At this moment, half the people in American prisons are black. At this moment, more than half of the people being sent to American prisons are black. That enormous increase of the black presence in American prisons is the result of conscious social policies of conservative crime controllers over the last decade. That seems to me shameful, but it also seems to me seriously and deeply destructive.
Why do you think there is such a high proportion of black men in prison now?
Among researchers who do what I do for a living, black and white, conservative and liberal, with only polar exceptions, there is broad agreement that the principal reason why so many more blacks are in prisons, relatively speaking, than whites, is that blacks have much higher rates of commission of the serious kinds of crimes, like rape and homicide and aggravated assault and murder, that traditionally have placed people in American prisons.
And why is that? Why is that?
The reasons for that have been understood since W.E.B. Du Bois, a great American black intellectual at the turn of the century, wrote about it, and continuously since. Black Americans, much more than whites, live in social and economic conditions that structure what researchers or what social theorists call life chances. The life chances of American black kids, American black babies, on average, are substantially less at birth than the life chances of whites for all the reasons that we've always known influence the choices that people make in their lives. Broken homes, low income, living in devastated neighborhoods, insufficient educations. All of those things disproportionately affect American blacks. And that's the reason why these rates are so much higher.
But what you're saying is that the black crime rate hasn't really gone up since 1980. What has changed is the disproportionate punishment of blacks.
That's right. One of the surprising lessons to me when I took on this subject that academics by and large have avoided for the last 25 years because it is so controversial is the discovery that if we go back to 1970, we would find that 42 or 43% of the people arrested for serious violent crimes were black. And it turns out that's the same percentage in 1975 and 1980 and 1985 and 1990 and 1993. I was surprised to find that because I suspected, partly on the basis of media accounts of what's happening in American cities, that violent crime rates involving blacks were getting worse and that that was at least part of the reason for why the numbers of blacks in prison have increased so much more rapidly in recent years than have the numbers of whites. So I discovered that if we want to try to understand why there are so many more blacks in prison and being sent to prison, the reason wasn't that blacks are increasingly committing the kinds of serious crimes that traditionally in American history have caused the most severe punishments to be imposed. It wasn't that at all. And so the next job that I had was to try to figure out what it was that was causing the rates at which blacks are sent to prison and the rates at which they are in prison on any given day to be increasing so rapidly.
And what conclusion did you reach?
Well, there are two primary factors. The first, and much the most important over the last 15 years, was the war on drugs that was launched by initially the Reagan and then followed up by the Bush administrations, which, for a whole variety of reasons having nothing to do with racial patterns of who uses drugs and little or nothing to do with racial patterns of who sells drugs or who makes money from drugs, but did have the effect of greatly increasing the number of young minority males in the inner cities who were arrested for drug trafficking and sent to prison for very long terms. That's the single most important cause of the enormous increases in black punishment in this country.
Drug offense sentences are the single most important cause of the tripling of the prison population since 1980, yes?
That's true.
Statistic?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're saying that the war on drugs is one of the primary reasons why the African-American male prison population has grown in the numbers that it has. So what's the correlation between the war on drugs and the growing African-American male prison population?
Well, that correlation is clear. One way to express that is to look at the likelihood that black Americans and white Americans will be arrested for drug trafficking offenses. Throughout the 1980s, the rate at which white Americans were arrested for drug crimes was absolutely flat. I mean, only a statistician cares about the details, but the number was 300 per 100,000 whites were arrested for drug crimes on average every year for that 10-year period. In 1980, about 500 blacks per 100,000 were arrested for drug crimes, but by 1989, that had risen to 1,700. The white rate had remained stable. The black rate had tripled by a factor of three until it was five times higher than the arrest rate for whites for drug crimes. Now, that's the single most, and the sentences that federal sentencing policy and states that followed them have required for drug crimes have gotten longer and longer as the years have passed. That's the single most important reason why so many more blacks are caught up in the arms of the law today than was true 15 years ago, or than was true 5 years ago. A logical next question is, but wasn't it necessary to achieve the purposes of the war on drugs, to increase the rates at which people were arrested for drug crimes, and a corollary to that is, and if blacks were selling drugs more often than whites, then shouldn't we expect that arrest rates for blacks would be higher than that? The answer to the two questions that I just posed for myself are these. No informed drug policy expert, and I include both academics and senior federal officials, believed by the mid-1980s that massive levels of street arrests of drug dealers was going to have any significant effect on either the volume of drug use or the volume of drug crime or the prices of drugs as they are sold on the street. But despite that, the principal strategic approach that I think for ideological reasons that the Reagan and Bush administrations chose to pursue the drug war was street-level drug enforcement. Now, what drug policy experts in other countries would have told them, and what was well-known at the time, was that dollar for dollar and more importantly, much more likely to have an effect on drug use, was investment in drug treatment and drug education. Had we been serious as a policy matter about affecting drug use and drug crime in the United States, we would have invested in treatment and in education, not in massive street arrests, especially when we know now, and we knew then, that the enemy soldiers, as it were, in the war on drugs were going to be young minority males in the devastated inner city areas where drug trafficking is visible and where it's easy for policemen to make what is called a buy, to appear offering to purchase drugs and find somebody willing to sell them.
So let me see if I understand you. You're saying the war on drugs meant that a lot of young African-American inner city males ended up behind bars for using or selling drugs. And if they were using or selling drugs, shouldn't they have been behind bars?
Well, that's a hard question. I mean, I think it's not a hard question. Some of them should have been, of course. I mean, people whose real crimes are crimes of violence and are simply involved in drug trafficking, sure, prison is an entirely appropriate response for crimes of violence. As to the more general question, though, of whether it was justifiable to adopt a national drug policy that foreseeably was going grossly disproportionately to affect young black males, the answer is no, for two reasons. First reason is, we knew full well that massive arrests of street-level drug dealers in the inner cities was not going to reduce the volume of drug trafficking in America. The reality of the choices available to young, disadvantaged men in American cities are such that drug policy experts and cops will tell you now and would have told you 10 years ago that for every young dealer arrested on a street corner, there will be a replacement available within 2 or 3 days. The economic opportunities were just so attractive relative to the other opportunities people had available that we knew that we weren't going to affect the drug trade or the volume of drug use by wholesale arrests of young blacks. So as a matter of cause and effect, there was no cause and effect argument that could be made. So it was a futile policy. But more importantly, it was a policy which was foreseeably going to have an effect, which it did have, which was to worsen the conditions of life in the black community and in the families of those young black men, their parental families and the women with whom they were associated and the children whom they sired. Life became harder.
Michael Tonry is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Malign Neglect, Race, Crime, and Punishment in America. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Tonry, and he's the author of the new book, Malign Neglect, Race, Crime, and Punishment in America. There's a movement now in America toward stricter sentencing. For instance, the Contract with America and its crime bill calls for mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. What do you think of that?
It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea now. It's been a bad idea for the last 15 years when many states have had mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes and the federal government has had mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. Why is it a bad idea? Because we know and have long known that mandatory minimum penalties have virtually no effects on drug use or drug trafficking or crime rates when they're applied to other crimes. They're ineffective, but they're cruel. And so if the goal is to reduce drug use or drug trafficking, they won't do that. We also know that they're unnecessary. Offenders who've committed serious crimes, including serious greedy or violent drug trafficking crimes, receive prison sentences whether they're mandatory minimums or not. I mean, judges and prosecutors are in the business of imposing what they see as deserved penalties. In cases where judges and prosecutors don't think people deserve the kind of harsh penalty that mandatory minimums often require, they do one of two things. They evade the mandatory minimum penalty, or they impose it and hold their noses, knowing that they're violating their oath to do justice, but they're following the law. So mandatory minimums are bad public policy for drug crimes and for anything else.
What do you think of three strikes and you're out?
Three strikes policies are bad policies. They suffer the same problem that mandatory minimum laws do, which is we have no evidence at all that they have any effects on crime rates. They have no known deterrent effects on behavior, but they're bad public policy for other reasons. They sometimes capture small fry, like the Californian and like the man in California this fall who's going to prison for the rest of his life because he stole some pizza from some children in a schoolyard, it being his third felony. But they're also enormously wasteful and expensive. The estimates in California are that California is going to spend $240 additional billion dollars by the year 2030 because of its three strikes law. And it's not going to accomplish the public goods that are wanted. It's not going to deter crime first. But more importantly, it's going to hold people in prison long past the points in their lives when they represent any sort of a social threat. The other rationale for punishment besides deterrence, ordinarily, is what's called incapacitation, locking people up so they can't be predators. But we know that violence is highly skewed toward the young years of people's lives. Very few people who are violent even when they're in their 20s remain violent in their mid-30s and certainly not in their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. So it's an enormous waste of public resources and often unnecessarily cruel.
You've come up with some suggestions about how to ease the damaging social effects of crime control policies in America. And one of your suggestions is that judges should have the power to mitigate sentences to take into account an individual's background and circumstances. Why should a judge take into account an offender's background? And how should they take that into account?
What's interesting to me is that you would ask that question phrased in that way because it would have been common ground in the United States until 1980, and it remains common ground in every other Western country, that judges in setting sentences look at the seriousness of the crime and they look at the circumstances and background of the offender to decide both what is a just punishment for that offender for that crime and what's an appropriate punishment in terms of reducing the likelihood that that offender is going to appear in court again. The idea of what is called individualizing punishments is not a radical idea. It's only a radical idea in a framework in which the Contract for America is used as a base for thinking about what the options ought to be.
Well, a lot of people would say, well, isn't it a lot more fair to say that no matter who committed the crime gets this particular sentence, period. And everybody's treated the same. A lot of people say that would be the more fair way of doing it.
I think in the abstract, if you called someone up at 7 o'clock at night as part of a Gallup poll survey and asked them that question, they would give the answer that you just suggested. But when you deal with real living human beings, my experience is that certainly that criminal justice officials, judges and prosecutors and probation officers and defense lawyers, but more importantly, ordinary people do want to make distinctions. Take theft, for example. People want to distinguish between a person stealing food or stealing money because there's absolute want in the household to feed a starving child, to take a soppy melodramatic kind of case, between a defendant and an offender who's drug dependent and is stealing money to pay for a drug habit, a defendant who is a professional thief and steals money as a way of earning a living, a defendant who steals purely out of caprice. Most people want to make those kinds of moral distinctions. It isn't simply offenses that lead to most decisions about what's just, but it's the circumstances in which offenses take place, the motives of the people who commit them, the background of the person who did it.
Your new book, Malign Neglect, is about race, crime, and punishment. And as you've pointed out, there is a very high percentage of young African-American men who have prison records now. That leads a lot of people to conclude, well, that's because young black men are more violent or more prone to using drugs, therefore they're more dangerous. And I think that prison record has had the effect of increasing the amount of fear people have about young black men. What would you say about that?
Well, that's an unintended side effect that I hadn't ever expressed in those terms. If it is true, as I've said earlier in this conversation, that American drug policies have given many more young minority males criminal records and prison records than was necessary, Your proposition that having a criminal record makes people look even more dangerous and makes the public even more likely to want to be severe and harsh is another dimension to it. I agree with the point that you make.
Are you often asked if you've ever been a victim?
Yes.
And have you? And is that relevant? Should that be relevant to our opinion about your views on crime and punishment?
Well, I've been asked the question, and the answer is I've been burglarized a half dozen times and once was the victim of a fairly violent street mugging on 52nd Street in New York City. So the answer is yes, I've been a victim of crime and of violent crime. As to whether that should matter to how either what I think or what people think about what I think the answer is no. The justice system is about justice. The social welfare system is about the welfare of Americans, and that too is about justice, not criminal justice, but social justice. And I don't think the question of who's been victimized is especially important to it. In the U.S., in the 1990s and in the 1980s, there has been a misperception that life is becoming more dangerous for most people most of the time. I take it almost implicit in your question is a proposition, well, but crime has been getting worse and the public is frightened by it and concerned by it, and so politicians have to do something about it. It's just not true. I won't cite all the statistical and social science evidence that suggests it's not true. For the vast majority of Americans, the 90-95% who do not live in devastated inner city areas, the chances of victimization, especially violent victimization, have steadily decreased for 20 years. long before the current get tough on crime policies were adopted. The chances that people who are unfortunate enough to live, the 3 or 4 or 5% of people in the worst, most devastated inner city areas will be victims of violent crime have increased substantially. So that there's a maldistribution of crime, but overall, life is not getting more dangerous for Americans. And how that affects, whether I've been a victim, I don't know.
Well, that seems all really counterintuitive when you think of the number of guns in the streets now. But you know the old cliche that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged?
Well, I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal who's been mugged, and I'm not conservative.
So after you were mugged, did you want to make sure that that person stayed behind bars a long time, or would you have been particularly angry if you found out that this was somebody's like third mugging, and they kept getting put into jail, and they're out again, and they got you the third time they were out?
I'm not sure I'd be especially interested in that kind of rationalization. Violent crimes, it seems to me, not inappropriately often result in prison sentences. Now, they don't need to result in 5 and 10 and 20-year prison sentences, as is typically the case in the U.S., but I would have no problem if the person who mugged me, who was never caught, to my knowledge, had gone to jail for 60 days or 90 days. I would object if they'd gone to jail for 5 years or 10 years, but I think that's cruel and useless.
Michael Tonry, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Tonry is the author of the new book Malign Neglect, Race, Crime, and Punishment in America. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.